it's time for your weekly dose of Wayne's Comics.
Welcome to episode 678 of the Wayne's Comics Podcast. Thanks so much for listening. This week, writer Alisa Quitney from Howl, which is published by Ahoy Comics, is our guest. The first issue of Howl is now available at local comic shops, with the second arriving soon. Howl is described this way. In the late 1950s in Greenwich Village, alien spores are the last thing on 23-year-old beatnik and proto-feminist Ziva Rodblatt's mind. She's too busy trying to keep her mother from discovering that she's living out of wedlock with her boyfriend. But when said boyfriend falls under the sway of celebrity therapist Myrtle Morell, she begins to grow suspicious. We discuss how this miniseries came to be, who the various characters are, and what else Alisa has coming our way in the months ahead. Be sure to let your local comic shop know that you want to catch up on this book, even if they need to backorder copies of each issue. I'm sure you're going to enjoy what Alisa has to say. There's a lot to get to in this episode, so let's get on with the show. Howl is a witty bohemian sci-fi that can best be described as Mrs. Maisel meets Invasion of the Body Snatchers. I've never heard anything like that before. The five-issue series is set in Greenwich Village in the late 1950s, the home of poets, artists, musicians, sci-fi writers, their put-upon partners, and the extraterrestrial spores that are secretly taking them over. Again, I haven't heard that before, so there's all kinds of good things going on. The book is called Howl. The first issue is available now, and I'm having the chance to talk with writer Alisa Quitney. How you doing, Alisa?
How are you? I am free of alien fungal spores at the moment.
Okay. I guess that's a huge kick. I was talking with you before we started to record about the fact that the 1950s is not a decade that many people want to talk about these days. It's the 80s all the way, you know, the shopping malls and music stores and all those kinds of things. But you're exploring the 1950s. So do you want to talk with people about why you want to do that?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I think that there are people who are definitely yearning for the 1950s. And I always interpreted Make America Great Again as Make America 1950s Again. At least the common perception of the 1950s as a time when, you know, women were happily, you know, housewifing it up and raising adorable little children who were not only, you know, cleaving to their original gender, but in you know, Sally wore a white, you know, crinoline under her pink skirt, and Dick and Jane had their respective roles. So there's, I think, a part of the population and a part of the culture that is definitely looking back to the 50s right now. But the 1950s was not what it looked like from Hollywood's presentation and from the TV shows like I Love Lucy and Leave It to Beaver. You know, the 1950s, first of all, that appearance of everything being domestic bliss and everyone safe in their roles was a reset, because the culture had changed. In World War II, women were, you know, first of all, they were in the army, they were in the armed forces. Women were also back home doing men's jobs in factories. Women were wearing trousers a lot more. So there was this whole shift. And prior to that, there'd been the shift of the 1920s, which had upended roles and, just in terms of the fashions and what women were claiming as freedoms. So the 1950s was this look backward, but there was this unease underneath it all. If you look at the Twilight Zones, the Twilight Zone original Rod Serling episodes, those were, I think, I can't remember the exact dates, either late 50s into early 60s or early 60s. And those showed this, you know, profound alienation and fear of you know, alien invasions and just the monsters being ourselves. So that's, that was sort of underneath a lot of the 1950s. And then, of course, there were the beatniks.
I've got to read this paragraph that's in the release. It makes me smile. It dives into the story a little bit. It says, aliens are the last thing on 23-year-old beatnik and proto-feminist Ziva Rodblatt's mind. She's too busy trying to keep her mother from discovering that she's living out of wedlock with her boyfriend. But when said boyfriend falls under the sway of celebrity therapist Myrtle Morrell, she begins to grow suspicious. Why is Bert sneaking out before dawn to meet strangers? Why does he have a sudden taste for cream of mushroom soup? And Ziva is not the only one who believes that she is living with someone who looks familiar, but is unmistakably and disturbingly different. All of a sudden, there seem to be a lot of writers, artists, and musicians falling under Myrtle's spell. But what can one feisty college dropout do to fend off the alien invasion? I find that really kind of fun. Now, it does say in the release, I think that a lot of this area, some of the information came from your mom?
Yes. Okay. So there's a lot of different ingredients in Howl. Some of the ingredients are, you know, from the tropes of invasion of the body snatchers and that unease that permeates a lot of the science fiction and horror and B movie plots of the late 50s, that sense of whom can you trust and who do I know? But then in a different way, it's the story of my mother and father. My mother, Ziva Quitney, was an English major at NYU before she got involved with my father, the science fiction writer Robert Sheckley. So they were living in the village, and there are actually whole lines of dialogue in the first issue that are lifted from my mother's memories of you know, what my father said to her, that let's not put fingers in each other's souls, which was, I think, a very beatnik way of saying, you know, I'm not ready for a committed monogamous relationship. Mm-hmm. And she said that the moment, you know, he said that, as if Hollywood arranged it, the phone rang and it was somebody wanting a date, which I absolutely worked into the comic book. So it's, and I should say for listeners who don't know Robert Sheckley's work, he was he belonged to the Hydra Club, which was the real name of that science fiction club that included a lot of the science fiction writers of the day. I obviously renamed it because Hydra these days sounds like a Marvel supervillain club. But he wrote absurdist, humorous short stories, and is considered an unacknowledged influence on Douglas Adams, although, as I say, Douglas Adams did not acknowledge it. Mm-hmm. And maybe it wasn't, but if you like Douglas Adams's stuff, you would probably like Robert Sheckley's. And, you know, one of his, I think Free Jack is one film, but the film that people think of when they think of Robert Sheckley, his story, The Seventh Victim, got turned into the movie The Tenth Victim, which has got Marcello Mastroianni and Ursula Andress wearing that iconic silver bullet brassier that shoots. I think that's what, the spoof, the Mike Myers spoof. Austin Powers did a riff on that.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, it's funny you're saying stuff that, because I'm old enough, I was born in the middle of the 50s. And when I went to high school, one of the biggest fights we had, girls wanted to wear pants. And it was not allowed in the high school where I went to school that for girls to wear pants. And there was this massive fight about the whole business. And I remember it passed and the girls got, I remember the first day the girls came in pants and some of the guys were not happy with that. I was like, that's what they want to wear. Sure, let them go ahead. But it was just, I'll never forget. We haven't seen anything like that since that era. These earthquake kind of cultural shifts that went on. And you're talking about before all those things started to happen or as they're on the cusp of it. So that's an interesting time. I'm always fascinated by times before change. And it sounds like you're dealing with that era quite a bit.
Absolutely. So I think the Beat Generation, you know, which the Beatniks, so that is a period from, I would say, the 40s into the late 50s is the beat era in Greenwich Village. And so you have the classic image of the beatnik is the man has a goatee and he's wearing, you know, and maybe, you know, glasses and a beret. The woman's got her hair pulled back in a ponytail and she's wearing sandals and a black turtleneck. And everyone's probably smoking the French cigarettes and quoting Sartre. So the thing is that in so many ways, the beatniks were precursors to the hippies in every way, from smoking weed to professing free love, you know, and my, so my parents lived together in Greenwich Village before they were married, and they eventually did marry and they moved to the Upper West Side, but they had this really bohemian period of life, and I was fascinated by it. I'd always wanted to write about it, and but then I started to also get interested in this real life character of Mildred Newman, who was their therapist. And you made me think about her because my mother was seeing Mildred Newman, and I think she wanted to wear pants. And one of my mom's friends also, you're going to hear, everybody saw Mildred Newman, the celebrity therapist. So the friend Peggy said, gosh, I remember Mildred saying that your mother was wearing pants. This was some kind of group, and that it was a way of being fearful of her own femininity. And I knew that my mother was not fearful of her femininity. She felt that she had very skinny calves and preferred to not have them exposed in dresses.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting because, you know, I that whole era was so different. And now I got a whole bunch of questions I'm dying to ask because I got a chance to read the first issue. Why is it called Howl? I'm just fascinated by that.
Well, first of all, we did go through some different titles. Mm-hmm. My original title was Future Wife. And Tom Pyre, my editor, decided that might sound sort of futuristic in the wrong way, that it didn't sound like the Roger Corman-esque body horror story that it was becoming. So for a while, we called it Flesh Puppets. And I think it also went through a period of being called Of Flesh and Fungus, which made it sound like a turgid 1950s pulp novel. But eventually we got to Howl, which was both a nod to the famous Ginsberg poem, a famous beat, you know, poem, which is referenced a little later in the series. But also, if anyone has seen the 1978 Invasion of the Body Snatchers, there's this thing that happens. The pod-infected people point and open their mouth and give this inhuman, otherworldly screech, roar, howl to point out the non-pod person. Mm-hmm. And can I just tell a story that helps people understand who my mother was?
Sure.
Shortly after we saw the movie in 78, so I was 12 or 13, I was walking down Broadway and I see my mother and a friend. And my mom just points her finger at me and opens her mouth and does that, you know, like Donald Sutherland in the movie. Mm-hmm. She was just hysterical and irreverent mm-hmm. and funny.
Well, that's funny. Now, see, the interesting mix to the whole business is the alien spores. How much? I want to give away what's going on in the book, but how much influence on the culture did these spores have?
Well, okay, so the premise of the book is that there is an alien invading force, and they would like to take over the Earth, as you know, invading forces want to do. And the idea is that the United States was the power, you know, to reckon with at that time, and that everyone was sort of very willing to follow authority and conform, except for the beatniks, except for the writers and the artists and musicians who were counterculture and rebellious and nonconformists. So the idea was that you had to co-opt the intelligentsia, and then everyone else would fall in line. Mm-hmm. I want to say that there was a real inspiration to that, in that Mildred Newman, whom I've already mentioned, was a therapist who was not only seeing my mother and father and their friends, but I met a woman whose father was an abstract expressionist of the time. And sure enough, Mildred was seeing their parents, and they were in the same group with my parents. She was also seeing Anthony Perkins of Psycho fame and the actor Richard Benjamin, his wife Paula Prentice, and the directors Paul Simon, wow. Mike Nichols. The list goes on and on. And I found myself thinking, holy crap, why was she so compelled to be everyone's therapist? It's sort of a who's who of people in the village. Mm-hmm. And anyway, so that was sort of how I got the germ of the idea that she was trying to take over the Earth. In real life, obviously, Mildred Newman was not trying to take over the Earth.
Not that we know of, anyway. See, I'm kind of interested because I don't know if in that period we were conscious yet, but there were certain people who were trendsetters who started doing things, and the whole of culture eventually integrated a lot of that stuff, that they were the first to do those kinds of things. You know, the beatniks, you know, I'm glad you kind of explained what a beatnik is, because I don't think people today have any idea what a beatnik is. When you say that, because it's so fascinating to me. But, you know, that whole business, the beatniks were counterculture stuff, and people did stuff, and then it turned into hippies, and then that whole thing integrated, you know, jeans and long hair and other kinds of things all integrated into the everyday culture. And then the funniest thing to me, of course, was after all this stuff happened, they all went, all these counterculture people went out and got jobs as bank tellers and things like that, which I found so funny. So
not all of them. I have to say that my mother's crowd on the Upper West Side for a long time, you know, it remained a really bohemian enclave. And I think it's gotten a lot harder now for artists or academics to remain in the city. But, you know, in the Upper West Side of my growing up, it was still a place where, you know, people's bookshelves were filled with well-thumbed, you know, tomes of philosophy and Greek tragedy. And I discovered that I knew Murray Kempton was one of the people who lived in my mom's building, the building where I grew up. And I knew him as this sort of nattily suited and gray, disapproving man. And when I started to read Halberstam's book on the 50s, I discovered that Murray Kempton was this incredible journalist and huge intellectual influence on the 1950s. I thought, oh, yeah, I remember Murray. I just was a kid and didn't know who or what he was.
Interesting. But you said something. I've got to go. I got to pull out here for a second. You said that it's hard today for like artists and creators and stuff like that to stay in the city like they used to. Well, I haven't noticed that. Whenever I've gone to cities, I still find a lot of that kind of person still there in the cities. Yeah, from your perspective, that's no longer happening. Is that true?
I think there are always some, but for an example, and maybe they're in different neighborhoods. I'm definitely in different neighborhoods, mm-hmm. but on the Upper West Side, I have my mother and father's letters, and you know, she's talking about the rents and what was. I'm really bad at retaining numbers, but you could be a struggling freelancer and afford the, you know, a gorgeous big apartment on the Upper West Side. In as recently as the 1970s, 80s, there were people who were independent documentary filmmakers that didn't always know how much money they'd have. And they were able to share, you know, rooms and live on the Upper West Side. I don't think there's very much of that left.
That's interesting, because I know I've heard people talk about how much it is to rent an apartment in New York. And it's like a whole year's salary for some of us. And I'm like, wow. So, yeah, you're right. If people were like artists and you never knew exactly how much money you were going to make, New York, it may not be the place to go anymore as far as that goes.
It's definitely different. So one of the elements about Howl is that the apartment where Ziva and Bert live has a bathtub in the kitchen. And that's a feature of a lot of these old tenement apartments. Mm-hmm. And that would have been called a cold water flat. I believe that the toilet would have been in the hall and would have been shared.
Wow.
And unfortunately, I can't ask my mom to remind me anymore. But I, you know, even now you can look up and see there are random houses that haven't been renovated and people rent them out and there isn't a toilet inside the apartment. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, there are little vestiges of the New York that was grittier. It really was gritty. I mean, just growing up, nobody that I knew had air conditioners. So, you know, the Howl is set in August and, you know, just the heat of everything is part of it. Because I was thinking about alien spores and what would make them flower and flourish. And it definitely had to be a summer book.
So interesting. Let's talk a little bit about the characters, because I was talking with you before we started to record about the fact that sometimes characters and stories are based on people you know, people that come from your imagination. Let's start with Ziva. Where does she come from? Who is she patterned on anybody, or is she somebody that you created?
Ziva is my mother, just very much my mother. They're a little, in terms of her physicality, I think Moise, my wonderful collaborator, modeled her a little bit also on Audrey Hepburn, who famously played a beatnik in Funny Face, 1957.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
But Ziva, in terms of her personality, was very much my mother. And yeah, so that's she's I thought at first I wasn't going to give her my mother's actual name. And then my mom and I were incredibly close our whole lives. She died this year. And I just thought, you know, she would really enjoy this, the fact that we are all going to be talking about her this year. I mean, the people who read Howl.
It's tough when the parent goes, your whole perspective is different on life. Because when my mom and my dad passed, I remember thinking, gosh, you know, that umbrella that kind of keeps you safe from other stuff is no longer there. And so, and also my window onto their era, you know, they my parents were born like in the 40s, and to them it was, you know, 50s and stuff like that was just strange. They couldn't figure it out kind of stuff.
Mm.
So they were always, we were always told, no, I wouldn't look at those crazy people so much kind of thing. But the truth of it is that they were fascinating because it was something new and different. And so Ziva, I guess, represents that. What about the boyfriend? I mean, is he based on somebody?
So I included him in the first issue because of that story of how my parents met, that she had actually read his short story Warm in high school. And then they met at a party and they went on a date. And he said, you know, let's not go putting fingers in each other's souls. And then the phone rang and she went on a date with the guy who asked her out. And when she got back from the date, she agreed to go and reassure my father. And he said, oh, fine, you've won. Let's lock this thing up. So that's when they became a steady couple. Mm-hmm. But later in the series, I realized that I needed to bring the boyfriend character back. So I built him up into more of a person. And I, at that point, he became an amalgam of, you know, people I knew that my mom had dated and just sort of an invented character.
Okay. There is a sequence that I have to ask about because there's, you know, Ziva's there and her mom shows up and goes into her apartment and starts digging through things. And she comes across the bed and there, let's just say there's things on the bed that she didn't expect to find there. So
yes, indeed. And it's a Murphy bed and Ziva has thrown, you know, everything that she didn't want her mother to see into the Murphy bed and her mother just pulls it down. So Bubba is the name of the grandmother and is absolutely modeled on my grandmother. There's stuff that happens later on that I really incorporate a lot of stuff about my grandmother. I didn't know when I started writing this, I thought it was going to be primarily a story about how in the world of the late 50s, you know, these bohemian, futurist, forward-looking writers could see the possibility of aliens as people, but had a lot of difficulty seeing the women in their lives as people. And so that was going to be the focus. But as the series continued, I really ended up finding that a major subplot is the relationship of Ziva and her mother and trying to figure out how much she's going to rebel and push away and what she's going to hold on to.
There's a funny sentence partway through the book where a woman shows herself dressed very well and she tells these two guys, artists and writers don't live up by the same clock as ordinary folk, so neither do I. She says, well, that was a wonderful line in that whole business. And
that's Myrtle. That's Myrtle Morell.
That's her. Okay, good. Because one of the things I really enjoy about your writing is the humanity that you breathe into the various characters. You know, I feel like I'm sitting with people and it's not a story so much as I'm sitting there in real life on a park bench and these people are talking and I'm getting to sit there and listen to them. Which I think is really, now the thing, of course, that shakes me out of that are the aliens. Wait a minute, there's aliens here. Hold on a second. So this whole thing is really kind of funny. How it pulls me into the story, and then something comes along, and I go, "Oh, wait a second, this is something that's a little different than that." So I like the way that I'm never quite settled when I'm reading this story. You know, we're riding on subways and we're looking in apartments, and then all of a sudden the guy's got red eyes. And I go, well, oops.
I have to say that for me and for Maurice, my artist, my collaborator, we love for everything to feel very grounded emotionally. And so I hope I always aim to do that in the dialogue. But what Maurice is able to do, sorry, Maurice is, you know, the name, he is his artist name, but mm-hmm. I call him Alain. Mm-hmm. What he does is in the acting, the subtle nuances of people's expressions to each other. That is part of what I think grounds it. And then it is my great hope and love that the outlandish stuff, the alien stuff, actually brings out these really human moments, so that all of it ultimately is tropey and fun, but in service still of the relationships and of the story itself.
Well, I always got a kick out of comics because comics could take me where other things could not. You know, and so like unlimited science fiction budgets and stuff, like special effects and stuff like that. And I was always intrigued, you know, how would we react in a situation like that? And when you throw these unusual things against human beings, we get to see them. And I always have to ask myself, would I react the same way in that circumstance? So for me to see them and how they interact, and yeah, the aliens are kind of the wild card in the situation. It's something that's a little different. We're kind of going along, and then this curveball comes in. And the curveball is what makes it a lot of fun, because, you know, people like to think they've got pretty good control over their lives and stuff like that. But in reality, we get hit with a curveball, and we have to figure out how we're going to survive and do things. And I love the way that you use the aliens as one of the curveballs that people get hit by. And I think that's going to be a lot of fun. And of course, the first book kind of sets a lot of stuff up. And so I'm anxious to see what happens. You know, I do have to say, 50s science fiction always appeals to me.
Oh, me too. And, you know, it's part of what appeals to me so much in terms of written science fiction is it's really interested in people. There was this movement away from space opera and very technological stuff and into sociological and psychological science fiction. And, you know, I think a lot of people know the stories of that era through Rod Serling's Twilight Zone and, you know, don't realize that there's just a lot of stuff out there that's like that. And that if you love the Twilight Zone and that sensibility, you should go and read, you know, Robert Sheckley and Harlan Ellison and Theodore Sturgeon and, you know, Asimov and, you know, go back to the source.
My mom forbade us after a while from watching science fiction because I'd watch this stuff and I couldn't sleep that night. There was one time in a Star Trek episode there, the people were turned into cubes and one of them got crushed.
The salt monster.
And I just, that night I remember laying there thinking I could get turned into a cube and crushed. And my mom said, no more of that. I couldn't watch Star Trek again until we got to college. And then I every night at 6 o'clock, the local TV station would run it in syndication. I'd sit and watch it. And I came across that episode. I said, that's what scared me when I was a kid. But the thing that's interesting about it is again, we're faced with stuff that's outside the realm of possibility. And how do we respond? I love that kind of stuff. I mean, I always got a kick when the aliens would show up and they would be human in appearance. What was the one where the guy came out of the ship and he took his helmet off and he looked like a human?
In Star Trek?
No, it's just a
in the Twilight Zone?
It wasn't Twilight Zone. It was just a general movie in I can't remember the name of it, but I mean, the guy who was the actor, I can see his face in my head, but I can't remember the name of the movie. But he walks down the plank off of the spaceship, which of course was like a UFO. And he comes out, and the helmet comes off, and he looks like a human, but you know, there's a lot of questions. Is he really that human, or is he just looking like a human kind of stuff? And I remember that scaring the heck out of me. But as I grew older, I was like, I kind of like being scared sometimes. And so for me, those things, which I couldn't see as a kid because it scared me too badly, now all of a sudden I'm like, okay, they're saying something interesting with that. So I always liked that.
Oh, absolutely. And I wanted very much for this series to also convey a lot of, you know, the things that I had loved the most. I mean, some of the influences that are in here are 1950s, like Roger Corman's Bucket of Blood, which is sort of Beatniks, you know, when Beatniks go bad, about a frustrated artist and his bloody, bloody path to acceptance among the Beatniks. But also, sorry, my little dog, my dogs have just opened the door to come into the room. Sorry. But also Invasion of the Body Snatchers, Jack Finney wrote the original book and then it was a 1956 film. which is a great film. But for me, the definitive one is the 1978 version. And I think that is a very sociological invasion of the body snatchers. Mm-hmm. And I just want to throw in there, John Carpenter's The Thing. And 2 years later, so John Carpenter's The Thing was 1982. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously got the shape-shifting protean, you know, evil alien that occupies all these different bodies and jumps around and mutates and is, you know, Rob Bottin's wonderful practical effects. Mm-hmm. But then 2 years later, John Carpenter did Starman, which is a different kind of shape-shifting alien who turns into very young, very hunky Jeff Bridges, romancing young Karen Allen. And I felt in a way that what I wanted to do was imagine if the alien of The Thing and the alien of Starman were kind of the same guy.
Interesting. You remind me very much of Star Trek Deep Space Nine, which is my favorite, which has all the shapeshifters in there.
You know, I never watched that one. I got to go back.
I highly recommend it. It's my favorite of all the Star Treks because it's you're getting away from what they used to call the galactic one-night stand. You would go someplace, you'd mess everything up, and then you'd leave and let the people deal with it. On Deep Space Nine, it was a space station, and it was near a planet. They had to deal with the consequences, which I always loved about that show. You know, we couldn't fly away and let the people deal with it. They had to every day deal with stuff, which I thought was just tremendous. So I love that. That was why it's still to this day, as much as they've had millions of versions of Star Trek, that's the one that stands out to me because of that. And yet you never knew if the person you're talking to was the real person or was just a fake.
I think that's such an interesting theme. In part because we don't ever really know what's going on inside of even the people we're closest to. Mm-hmm. And I think also, so another influence on me, there was a film in the 80s called The Return of Martin Guerre with Gerard Depardieu. And it's based on a real story that this man, Martin, went away to the war, leaving his wife behind, and comes back many years later, knowing all the things that only Martin would know, mm-hmm. but seeming subtly different. And increasingly, people begin to suspect that he is not the real Martin. Mm-hmm. And yet his wife, it becomes clear, is sort of preferring this new and improved Martin. Mm-hmm. So that was another influence on me, that thought of, you know, what if you don't know for sure if this is the person who they say they are? And mm-hmm. what if in some ways you might like this version better?
There's one sequence I have to tell you that spooked the heck out of me. The captain, the Avery Brooks, who played the captain, was on Earth. He's sitting on a bench. And all of a sudden, up walks and sits down to him is a person he knows is galaxies away on the space station. Mm. And he looks at him, and we know this is a shapeshifter on Earth. And he starts saying things. Look at all the chaos we've created. You know, there's only just about a few of us on this planet, and look what we've done to this place. And all of a sudden, he gets up and walks away. And poor Ben Sisko was sitting on the bench going, what just happened here? And that scared the heck out of me. I have to say that was a tremendous thing about that. I really loved that. So anyway, enough about Deep Space Nine. The thing about this book is it gives me that same sort of vibe. We're not exactly sure what's going on. That's a good thing. I like being off balance. I like having the reason and figuring, look at things and say, wait a minute, what is going on here? So I like that.
Well, it's an unsettling moment in history. And we get, I think all of us are having this feeling of living through history. And so it seems right and good that, you know, I write stories that are unsettling.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Now, the only question I have, and of course, I have to wait till the last issue to find out, do the spores take over the Earth? That's the question we have to know.
That is always the question, I think, that we all ask ourselves. Sometimes before we go to bed, Mm-hmm. And sometimes when we wake up in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What did we just wake up to? What happened while we were sleeping? That's the kind of stuff. That's the thing about science fiction that always appeals to me is that, you know, things that we take for granted, suddenly we cannot take for granted anymore. This book does a lot of that. And it's really good that we're uncertain what's going to happen next. And I have to say, one of the things about television and some science fiction that drives me nuts is it's so predictable.
Mm.
I've seen this stuff, especially if you're somebody like me who's seen a lot of it and read a lot of it. You kind of sit there and go, oh, this is that story. We're going to X and X and X. And then when they do it, you're kind of like, oh, yeah, I saw that coming a mile away. But when I don't know what's going to happen, that I treasure that. And that's the way I am with your book. I have no idea what you're going to do in coming issues and stuff. You've done a beautiful job of setting up the people and the circumstances. And we know there's curveballs coming our way left and right. And I like that. The thing I want to know is now what? What's going to happen next? And when I don't know that really thrills me no end, because there's too many times in comics too, they've also had the trope where the last panel of the book is the cover. And so you get into the book and you get there and all of a sudden you get to the last panel and you knew that was coming because it was the cover. I like it when that doesn't happen. I like to not know. And this was your book, I Don't Know, and that I treasure that.
I'm so glad. Yeah, I think that if you are a person who digests a lot of books and a lot of movies, that delicious feeling, both the not knowing and feeling you're in steady hands, is really exhilarating. I don't get it often, but when I get it, when I think, oh, I don't know where you're taking me, but I know that you know where you're taking me, and you just kind of go back into reading the way you did when you were a kid.
I've often compared it to like driving a car. There's some people like to get into a car and just meander around the neighborhood and stuff like that. I want to get in a car with somebody who knows where they're going, and we know they know where we're going, but we don't know where it is they're heading. And then I kind of have to look around and say, where are we going? What's happening? I love that whole kind of thing. And I think that Howell does a beautiful job of telling me, you know where you're going. I have no idea, so I better pay attention. And I love that in a book and stuff. So just well done.
Oh, thank you so much.
It's so great. Now, so the first book is out, first issue of the five issue series. So I take it this is going to come out about the middle of the month, each month.
Yeah. So there's going to be five issues in total. And then after they're all out, they will be collected.
Ooh, okay. So if for some strange reason the store doesn't necessarily have the first issue, which, by the way, you can get digitally in case you – see, what I often do is if I can't get the physical copy, I'll buy a digital version. So like when the second issue comes out, I can buy the physical copy and kind of catch up with the first issue later on. But I know what's happening, so I can still read it. So that's why I recommend to people. This book is something to be read and to be enjoyed, because it's really something – like I said, I'm so used to the 80s that going back to the 50s is like, this is something so different that I'm kind of like, boy, the 50s, I didn't expect that. So I love that about it.
Oh, thank you.
It's great. So,
can I mention a place that I'm going to be appearing in?
Sure. Please do. So
there's Stuart Moore, who's a wonderful writer, former fellow editor at Vertigo Comics. He and I are going to be doing a panel at Cosmic Con in Chelsea, February 15th or 16th. Mm. And so if you look up Cosmic Con in New York City next this coming month, then you can come and listen to us ask piercing, probing, alien insightful questions of each other.
And no alien spores.
Well, you know, one lucky audience member gets an alien score. Everyone can't get one.
Okay. Now, of course, you bring up a thing. If people want to follow you on social media, how do they do that?
So the easiest way, let's see, I'm, God, what am I? I'm on my website, www.alisaquitney.com. Instagram, I think I'm at k.witty. Blue Sky and Twitter, I'm at A. Quitney. And I think those are most of the places. If you go to my website, there are also other things. I've done some podcasts with my friend Lonnie Diane Rich. And yeah. And if there's anything new, I will also put it on my website.
Speaking of that, that's my next question. Are there other things you're working on that we should be on the prowl looking out for?
Well, there's a re-release in YA format of Mystic You. So if you haven't had a chance, if anyone hasn't had a chance to read that, that was a book I did with Mike Norton for DC Comics, and it's got Zatanna and Sebastian Faust and Sargon the Sorcerer and Rose Psychic, a lot of great DC supernatural folks. And so that's coming out March 4th. And other than that, I mean, I have a lot of backlist that I bet people haven't read all of, most of them. But I'm busy working on the next project with Morrissé.
Okay. Well, the good news is sometimes you can't say what it is, but that's good for us because that means it's coming and we'll find out when the time is right. So good to know.
Thank you.
So I have to say it's good. It's a great book. I'm fascinated as to what's going to happen next. And if you like something that challenges your thinking and makes you think and wonder what's going to happen next, Howl is the book for you, I would have to say. So Lisa, it's been great to talk with you, and I wish you much success. Is there any chance there's going to be a Howl 2?
Ooh, I would love to do. I would probably, you know, that's one of the things that Morrissey and I have discussed because we collaborate a lot. And I think it might nip into the future a little bit. And you know, there's also our series Guilt, which goes back in time to the 70s, also in New York City. So I have all these ideas about how those worlds intersect. But whatever comes next, I can promise it will have humor and body horror and and hopefully tickle everyone in where they want to be tickled.
That humor and body horror, that's an interesting combination, I have to say. So good stuff. Well, Alisa, I wish you much success with this. I do hope we get a Howl 2, maybe a Howl 3 or 4 even when we're doing it and other good things. And I hope people keep up and make all your things successes because we need lots of good writing and good storytelling in comics. And I think this is one of the ways to bring in new readers and to expand people who love variety like me. So keep it up.
Thank you so much.
If you're enjoying this show, I would greatly appreciate your support. For $5 a month, you can ensure I'm able to bring you interviews with comic creators week after week. You can support this show by becoming a patron at patreon.com/majorspoilers. Check out that address, again, patreon.com/majorspoilers, for more information. Thanks in advance.
People need dramatic examples to shake them out of apathy, and I can't do that as Bruce Wayne. As a man, I'm flesh and blood. I can be ignored, I can be destroyed, but as a symbol.
Get the latest from the comics universe. News, interviews, previews, and reviews. Listen to the weekly Wayne's Comics Podcast so you can keep reading your comics.
And that's it for this episode. Be back next time. I'll have another great interview with an excellent comics creator, something I'm sure you won't want to miss. But until then, keep reading your comics.